It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. Republicans in Wisconsin's 1st Congressional District are fighting hard to hold on to the seat House Speaker Paul Ryan has held for nearly two decades. As Laurel White reports, a former Ryan staffer is facing off in the race against a Democrat who's hoping to harness party enthusiasm to flip the seat.
Last year, millions of dollars started flowing into Wisconsin from all over the country with one purpose: defeat Paul Ryan in 2018. The money mostly went to Democrat Randy Bryce, an iron worker and union activist who had run and lost previous elections for state and local offices. But Bryce clearly struck a chord this time with his campaign announcement video released in June 2017.
I think it's time. Let's trade places. Paul Ryan, you can come work the iron, and I'll go to D.C.
Bryce's ad went viral. He got millions of dollars in out-of-state campaign contributions and the endorsement of Senator Bernie Sanders, who won Wisconsin's Democratic presidential primary in 2016. But almost a year later, the narrative changed when Paul Ryan dropped out of the race.
What I realize is, if I am here for one more term, my kids will only have ever known me as a weekend dad. I just can't let that happen.
Republicans chose Brian Stile, an attorney and member of the University of Wisconsin Board of Regents, as their party's nominee for the seat. In an early campaign ad, Stile introduced himself as a conservative outsider who could bring Wisconsin-style politics to Washington.
Because I was raised right here in Janesville on Southeast Wisconsin-style values, I don't care much for Washington-style politics.
It's Stile's first campaign for office, but he's hardly a newcomer to GOP politics. He was once a staffer for Ryan and was a delegate at the Republican National Convention in 2016. Stile and his allies have tried to frame the race around Bryce's background. Republican groups have run ads pointing out that Bryce has been arrested 9 times for crimes including drunk driving and property damage. Joe Zepecki is a Democratic strategist who's worked on a number of campaigns in Wisconsin. He says Bryce has responded well to those attacks.
He's put it out there and said, this is who I am. Take it or leave it. You know what? We've got enough people with Ivy League credentials and who have never gotten in trouble in their whole life in Congress, and look where it's gotten us.
Not everyone agrees. Randy Bryce's own brother, James Bryce, supports Stile and even cut a TV ad on his behalf. Mark Grawl is a Republican strategist who's worked on statewide campaigns. He acknowledges Republicans are facing headwinds in the 2018 election, but says Stile has run a strong race in a GOP district.
I mean, I think he fits the district well. His background in manufacturing, I think, is a real positive right now. I think his work in the community with his family is something that is also a real positive, and I think a big contrast with Randy Bryce.
Bryce is trying to draw his own contrasts, comparing Stile's work as a corporate attorney to his own blue-collar background.
It's not about who's the more perfect person to represent you. It's about who understands the hardships that you're going to face in order to make your world a better place.
When it comes to issues, the two follow partisan divides seen elsewhere this election cycle. Bryce supports Medicare for All and the Affordable Care Act's protections for people with pre-existing conditions. Stile says more price transparency and increased use of health savings accounts would make the healthcare system better. The race doesn't have the national profile it once did, but millions of dollars are still being spent here. As Stile fights to hold on to a GOP district, and Bryce tries to harness Democratic enthusiasm to flip it. Laurel White, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Now we turn to another race being watched, the U.S. Senate race. The race between incumbent Democrat Tammy Baldwin and her Republican challenger Leah Vukmir is heating up in the final weeks before the election. The two will meet in the first of three debates tonight at 6 o'clock at UW-Milwaukee. Are you an undecided voter in this race? What could either candidate say tonight that would win your support? 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234, ideas@WPR.org, or you can tweet us at WPR Mornings. My guest in this segment of the program is David Cannon, professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. David, thank you for joining me this morning.
Good morning. Good to be with you.
So how would you characterize the tone of the Senate race so far?
Well, it's been about like the other races we've seen around the country, pretty hard-hitting, a lot of negative ads. Both candidates are trying to make a positive case for their campaigns as well, but certainly you have to say that most of the ads that are being run have a negative tone, especially the outside ads. And this is going to be another one of these races where we see, you know, millions of dollars of outside spending being spent, and that those ads almost always are negative.
The two candidates will meet tonight for the first of three debates before the election. What should we be watching for tonight? What would be the biggest thing we should hope to see?
Well, I think one thing that's going to come up probably is the general tone of politics in Washington. I think we've seen in the last couple weeks with the Kavanaugh confirmation hearings and the whole debate about that, that our country is even more deeply polarized now than ever. And so I think there'll be a focus on that tone of politics. And like both Baldwin and Buchmeier are going to make an effort to try to say that, you know, they want to work with the other party and rise above that tone, because that's something that voters are hungry for right now. It's just a change from that kind of nastiness we've seen in the last couple of weeks.
Are you surprised that there will be three debates between now and the election?
Well, they certainly are pumping them towards the end. Usually they're more spaced out. I mean, three is a pretty traditional number. Two or three debates in a Senate race is not unusual. I think what's unusual is to have all three of them, you know, clumped so close to the end of the election, and that is fairly unusual. But I think it's good for the voters in an election like this where there are still a fair number of undecided voters. And also the other key thing in a midterm election is getting people to the polls, that often we see turnout, you know, under 35% nationally. In Wisconsin, we're usually in the top, you know, two or three in the state in turnout, but still turnout lags well behind where it is in a presidential year. So one thing a debate like this can do is to try to get a little more voter interest, especially try to mobilize the base, is something we'll see both Buchmeier and Baldwin trying to do, I think.
I guess the reason for my question is that the debates tend to be better for the challenger than for the incumbent. What's the risk for Tammy Baldwin? What is the challenge for Leah Buchmeier, and what does she hope to gain?
Well, yeah, sometimes that certainly is the conventional wisdom, that the challenger has more to gain from a debate like this. And right now, Baldwin is pretty comfortably ahead in most polls. Most polls have her 10-11% ahead. So I think Baldwin is comfortable in the debate format like this, that she generally performs pretty well in debate. So I think she, you know, feels confident in her positions, enough confident to accept the three debates. And so I think, you know, Buchmeier clearly has more to gain here, because she's the one who's trailing, and she'll try to be, you know, making a case for why voters should try something different in this election.
One of the focal points of the race has been Senator Baldwin's handling of a situation at the Tomah VA hospital. What have we been hearing from the candidates here?
Well, right. There have been some tough back and forth ads on this one, where Buchmeier has accused Tammy Baldwin of a cover-up in the opioid overprescription problem at the VA hospital in Tomah. There's been counter-ads by the Baldwin folks that actually have had the family of one of the veterans who died at Tomah from a drug overdose saying that the TAC ad is unfair, and they want Buchmeier to pull that ad, and saying that Baldwin has worked hard to pass bipartisan legislation to fix the problem. So this has been a very intense issue, certainly, and one that I think that it's getting a fair amount of attention, certainly, in the campaign.
As our conversation continues on this race going forward here, we'll talk about the two candidates' positions relative to the confirmation of Brett Kavanaugh to be a United States Supreme Court Justice and the role of gender in the Senate race. That's still to come. Plus, your calls at 800-642-1234. David Cannon is a professor of political science at the UW-Madison. I'm John Munson. This is The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. The race for U.S. Senate in Wisconsin is heating up in the final weeks before the election. The two candidates, incumbent Democrat U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin and her Republican challenger, State Senator Leah Buchmeier, face each other in the first of three televised debates tonight at UW-Milwaukee. Are you an undecided voter in this race? And what could either candidate say tonight that would win your support? 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. David Cannon is with us. He's a professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. So the confirmation process for Brett Kavanaugh is complete. He's now a justice of the Supreme Court of the United States. What have the two candidates been saying about the confirmation of Brett Kavanaugh?
Well, Tammy Baldwin, of course, was very much opposed to the nomination pretty early on, and definitely was someone who was speaking out against the nomination, and also saying quite strongly she believed Dr. Ford's testimony of sexual assault. Whereas Leah Bookmeyer has been, you know, taking the more sort of mainstream Republican line on this, which is she would have supported his confirmation, and also then, you know, echoing some of the points made about not having any corroboration of any other witnesses and saying this is not fair to Judge Kavanaugh's legacy and his integrity and his long career that he's had on the court. And so this is a really polarizing issue right now. I think for the base, it's probably the issue that's galvanizing both Democrats and Republicans more than anything we've seen in the last month or two, that it really riled up the Democratic base initially. And now, just in the last week after President Trump came out and attacked Dr. Ford, it seems to have also now galvanized the Republican base in a way as an unfair attack. Now, given that Kavanaugh has been confirmed, you would think that perhaps the anger over him being on the court should perhaps motivate Democrats more than Republicans at this point, because Republicans were able to get their nominee. But we'll have to see how that plays out.
How is gender playing into to the Senate race, or is it not coming up at all?
Well, it seems to not, you know, come up as much as you might think, but I think it is something that probably it helps the Republicans, I think, having a woman running against Tammy Baldwin, because Baldwin has run very strong across the state and appealed not only to women, but it's done, you know, pretty well with male voters as well. And so to have Leah Bookmeyer running as a challenger against Tammy Baldwin could perhaps reduce the gender gap to some extent. And we'll, I think, see perhaps a record-sized gender gap nationally in this midterm election because of Kavanaugh, because of Donald Trump. And so to the extent that Leah Bookmeyer can reduce that gender gap for Republicans in Wisconsin, give them at least something of a chance to be able to have a competitive race against Tammy Baldwin.
Let's take a call from Mary, who joins us from Pewaukee. Mary, thanks for joining us on The Morning Show.
Well, thank you very much. Thanks, John. Thanks to your guest. What I wanted to bring up is I rarely even watch the commercials, any commercials, much less political, because I'm not going to get my education and information from them. Many times they are mudslinging, but with Leah Bookmeyer trying to blame, for instance, Tammy Baldwin, the current senator who's done a fine job, I'm going to look into her, what she has really done. It seems like many times the mudslinging comes from the right a little bit more, and in the Toma case, for instance, Tammy Baldwin certainly wouldn't do a cover-up and has not done a cover-up of what's going on with the you know, the medicine at the VA in Toma. Mm-hmm. So that's my point, is I don't think a whole lot of people actually get their education, or I hope they don't, for the people that really vote.
So, Mary, for you, ads don't make a difference. You do your own research.
Exactly, and okay. Listen to NPR and get the experts' advices.
Okay, well, thank you. David Cannon, does Mary describe, do you think, a typical voter, or do a lot of people really get their information from ads they see on TV?
Well, sadly, Mary is not the typical voter, and I applaud her, and I wish more voters were like Mary to do their own research and look into things and not believe everything they see on ads. Because one really important point she makes is that the ads typically will have like some kernel of truth, but then blow it up in a way that ends up being, you know, very misleading. And so to take that Toma example, you know, in one of the Bookmeyer ads, you know, basically the ad blames Tammy Baldwin for, you know, not looking into this quickly enough to save this the one veteran who died. Well, it turns out he died like a day after she got the report. And so there's no way that she could have possibly intervened quickly enough to, you know, prevent that specific death. And so that's the kind of thing that I think Mary's referring to, that often these ads are very misleading. Now, unfortunately, research has shown that these ads do work, that people do pay attention to ads. I think it's less so today than it would have been, say, 6-8 years ago, because more people now are, you know, on the internet, on social media, and so the actual broadcast ads are not as effective as they were, say, 6-8 years ago.
Well, and a lot of people are using digital video recording equipment, and, you know, if you have a TiVo box, for example, you can hit a button and skip right through the entire ad cluster and get back to the show.
Right,
so a lot more of that as well.
No doubt. And that's one reason, another reason that the broadcast ads aren't as effective as they used to be.
So we know that there's a lot of money being spent on this. You mentioned that a lot of it is coming from outside groups. How much money are we talking about? Do we have a sense of the total number of dollars being spent and where it's coming from?
Yeah, we do. So the last reporting period for the FEC, they still haven't posted the September 30th reporting period. So the last we have is from July 25th. But even as of July 25th, Tammy Baldwin had raised over $22 million, and Vukmir's campaign was just getting going at that point, and she'd only raised about $2 million. I'm sure those numbers can be much higher by the September reporting period. But the outside spending already at the end of July, Tammy Baldwin had over $7.5 million spent against her and only $1.7 spent in favor of her. And so the outside dollars are going to be well over double that by the time we get to the end of the race on Election Day.
The latest Marquette University Law School poll released mid-September had Baldwin with an 11-point lead, which was a big bump from the month previous. A new Marquette poll is set to release this week. Do you think anything's happened in recent weeks that will move the needle for either candidate, David Cannon?
Yeah, I would expect the numbers should stay probably in the same range, or low double digits, high single digit lead for Baldwin. Yeah, it was 53-42 last time. And one thing that's noteworthy about that number for mid-September is only 5% undecided. You know, that many weeks out before the election, which is pretty low. So most voters have made up their mind already. You know, often in a race you'll see 8, 9, 10% undecided still in September, but the fact that we're down to just a 5% undecided already a couple of weeks ago means this is a race that I think getting a lot of attention, but also voters are pretty locked in terms of who they prefer, so probably won't see too much movement in this next poll that's released.
What could either candidate do at this point to attract that small sliver of undecided voters to their side of the ballot?
Well, I think the more crucial thing actually is something we touched on earlier, which is voter turnout. That at this point, not that many people are changing their minds. The key thing is getting your voters to the polls. I think it's one thing that both Democrats and Republicans are focused on here in Wisconsin, but also nationally. Just given that most people don't vote in midterm elections nationally, this is where the focus is going to be over the last several weeks, is getting your voters to the polls.
Which race is the bigger driver of getting people to the polls, this one or the governor's race?
That's a great question. It's not that often that you have two really hotly contested elections like this. And I would say they're probably both, you know, equally motivating for most voters. And like the Baldwin-Buchner race, the Walker-Evers race also is getting a lot of attention, but also has both sides pretty much locked in here. That, you know, Scott Walker has been around long enough that every voter in Wisconsin has an opinion whether they like him or don't like him. So you're not going to be seeing too many voters changing their minds, especially in the governor's race, I think. And there, again, it's going to be all about voter turnout.
Yeah, and well, I guess there's some question as to who helps who more. Does Baldwin help Evers more? Does Evers help Baldwin more? Same thing with Vukmir and Governor Walker, and those are certainly things we could probably spend another hour talking about, but we don't have time, so we won't. What else are you going to be watching for in tonight's debate? You said that there would be some talk about how to work with the other party and maybe heal some of the divide. What else are you looking for in tonight's debate?
Well, one thing I would expect Tammy Baldwin to do is trying to link Vukmir to Donald Trump. Donald Trump is not popular in Wisconsin. The latest Marquette poll had him at 42% favorable, 54% unfavorable, which is pretty comparable to the national numbers. And nationally, and here in Wisconsin as well, you see in the midterm elections, voters wanting to have a check on Donald Trump. So even if Trump isn't on the ballot, he's very much a looming presence in this election. And Democrats are trying to get their voters motivated by this idea of we need something to stop Donald Trump. And so I would expect Tammy Baldwin to try to link Vukmir to Trump and to say that, you know, she would be a voice in support of the president. I wouldn't be surprised if Vukmir tries to distance herself a bit from the president. But it's a difficult balancing act for her because she doesn't want to alienate that strong base of Trump supporters. And so she has to be pretty careful how she does that. She wants to try to portray herself as an independent voice, yet not alienating the Trump supporters.
David Cannon, thank you very much for joining us this morning.
Absolutely. Good to be with you.
David Cannon is a professor of political science at the UW-Madison. Coming up next, we check in on how the state is addressing the spread of chronic wasting disease and what the governor hopes to do about it. I'm John Munson. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network at Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm John Munson. As our state capitol report continues, we talk about the fact that Scott Walker says he'll work with lawmakers to slow chronic wasting disease. Last week, legislators voted against a rule to restrict hunters from moving deer carcasses out of some counties. Are you glad the legislative committee didn't support a rule that restricts movement of deer carcasses from CWD-affected counties? Why or why not? 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, ideas at WPR.org, or you can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Rich Kramer is a Wisconsin Public Radio reporter based in Eau Claire and host of The West Side with Rich Kramer. He's been following the story for WPR. Rich, thanks for joining us.
Good to be here. Thanks for having me.
Earlier this year, Governor Walker called on two state agencies to come up with emergency rules to combat chronic wasting disease. What came out of that?
All right. So in May, the governor basically ordered directives to the Department of Natural Resources and the Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection, also known as DADCAP, to come up with rules aimed at dealing with CWD. It's the first major action that the state had seen for some time on CWD. So DADCAP, since they regulate deer farms, they were charged with kind of looking into requiring additional fencing. So it could be a second 8-foot tall wire fence that some deer farms already have, or at the minimum, it would be electrical fence. The DNR was at first going to look at just the banning hunters from removing deer carcasses that they shot in counties that have CWD or that are nearby CWD positives. So the idea is that, you know, the old days when you'd see a deer on the hood of the truck or on the car rolling down the road, they want those animals, the spinal column and the brains and everything, to stay where the hunter shot them. So the idea was that the hunter would debone the deer and just bring the meat home and leave the carcass there. But it was interesting how it all played out. The citizen-led advisory boards for, or the citizen-led boards for the DATCAP, the Department of Agriculture, basically voted to do nothing. And then the DNR board took up the fencing issue as well.
Well, the fencing issue isn't anything new. I mean, there have been people who've been calling for better fencing around deer farms for a number of years.
Right.
The owners of the deer farms saying it's a waste of money and they can't afford it anyway. So that wasn't anything new. Let's talk about the restriction that would have prevented hunters from moving deer out of the areas of the state affected by CWD. That proposal rejected by the legislature, who killed the rule. What happened here, and what was the opposition about?
So the opposition was about the use of the emergency rule. At least that's what folks have said. You know, the emergency rules for DADCAP, DNR, whatever, it's meant to address a new, really threatening kind of a outbreak. So think of things like swine flu or bird flu. The emergency rule is meant so that agencies can take big action really quickly. The argument was that CWD has been around, you know, for a long time, 15, 18 years. So some felt that the emergency rule wasn't the proper way to go through with this. Some wanted this rule on hunters and the rule on fencing to go through either the regular rulemaking process, which can take a couple of years, or else through legislation. But instead, the governor chose to use the emergency rule process. The DNR basically wrote up a rule and passed it, the Natural Resources Board. So then Steve Noss, who's a Republican state senator out of Whitewater, he is a co-chair of this committee that gives final approval to administrative rules. So he basically announced his intention to kill part or all of this bill. And then on Monday, last Monday, they held an 8 or a 10 hour hearing, public hearing, and then they voted. They had the votes to kill the emergency rule on the hunter carcass transport. The argument was that hunters would be confused, that this rule was going too quickly. But I was surprised to see that they kept the rules on fencing. So that's where we're at right now.
Well, Rich, hang on. We have a caller, Dwayne, who I think wants to weigh in on this. He's calling us from Hayward. Let's take Dwayne's call now. Dwayne, welcome to the morning show.
Yeah, this rule is all intensive and all inclusive and doesn't have any common sense into it. I have friends that hunt on farms that the county line runs through the middle of the farm. So they would be breaking you off. They shot a deer on one part of the farm and took it home to process on another part of the farm. It'd be more like something, well, if you're 5 miles from the line, you can't move it or something like that, because it's just all-inclusive. You shall not do this. It's just crazy, because deer run across county lines all the time when you're close to them.
Dwayne, thanks for that call. What about it? I mean, how were they going to determine what the boundaries were for an area that is, you know, how you define an area affected by CWD and put that on a map?
Right. Even that is a bit confusing for people who don't, you know, follow it constantly, like us reporters or some lawmakers or whatever. But so if a county has they find a positive for CWD, there was one in Eau Claire County, for example, then the DNR looks at that, so that Eau Claire County would be CWD affected. But also, any county within 10-mile circle of that is also considered CWD affected, because deer do tend to move a bit. And that's where some of the confusion would have been. I mean, the hunters would have really had to have looked at the latest CWD maps to see where. There's 55 counties that are listed as CWD affected. So there definitely could have been some real confusion. And also, because the rule was set to go into effect immediately for this year's hunting seasons, the question was, well, are the DNR wardens going to start issuing, you know, citations? Because there's a learning period, you know. So it was unclear whether or not they were going to strictly enforce that or not, but nonetheless, the rule is gone. So for this hunting season, at least, it's not in effect.
Rich Kramer is a WPR reporter based in Eau Claire. He's been following the CWD story for Wisconsin Public Radio. We're wondering what you think should be done about chronic wasting disease, and what you thought of the governor's proposed emergency rule, perhaps also the rules about fencing for deer farms. 800-642-1234. The governor says he'll work with the legislature to reintroduce his emergency rule. Do we have any idea what will be different this time around?
I asked him that about 2 days just after the board voted to kill his part of his rule, and he said he was going to work with the legislature on that and in reintroducing it. He didn't say. I tried to get him to specify whether that would be through the normal rulemaking process or through legislation. He just said that, you know, he would work with lawmakers and reintroduce it. The during the hearing on these rules, a lot of the people that were for the carcass transport ban, and also for the CWD or for the fencing ban requirements, they were saying, if we don't act now, it's not going to happen. We've seen this come up politically before, and then when people say they're going to address it in the next session, it never happens. So that's part of the justification of folks that wanted to see these emergency rules in effect instantly.
Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, a rule that did go through, the deer fencing requirement, where are we on that?
Well, that is an interesting one, too, because the fencing requirement rule, once it goes into effect, it the deer farms that have had CWD positives, you know, they're required already to have double fencing. But this one would require enhanced fencing in any county that is listed as CWD affected. And also, so that rule will go into effect. They've got 365 days to comply with the rule, but because it's an emergency rule, the rules, I'm saying rules a lot, the emergency rules are only on the books for 150 days or so. There's possibility for extension. So the question is whether or not this emergency rule goes away before these deer farms or hunting ranches even have to come into compliance.
Hmm. So, meanwhile, more than, sounds like about three quarters of the counties in Wisconsin affected by CWD. How are people reacting to what's transpired regarding these rules? And I imagine the most of the reaction would be within the hunting community and those who follow this issue closely.
It's interesting. You've got some people who are very concerned about CWD decimating the deer herd, and then you've got other hunting groups that and groups of people that point to southern Wisconsin that had this, you know, they've got huge amounts of CWD down there, but yet they point out that the deer herd is actually increased. That is a complicated situation because now there's county deer advisory councils that committees that vote to grow the herd or reduce the herd, so there's some human factor in there as well. Mm-hmm. But it's just such a polarizing issue, and you know, back in the early 2000s when it first broke out, there was huge reaction, and lately it seems like a lot of people don't seem as worried about it.
Well, and deer hunting, a major piece of Wisconsin's, the traditions in the state, as well as being a pretty sizable amount of money that's spent on it, a lot of people involved in it, and certainly has been a big issue in the legislature, at least in terms of what people are likely to say about it. Mm-hmm. And I know, Rich, that you'll be following this story very quickly here. What do you think will happen next? Nothing's going to happen before the election, right?
Nothing before the election. And what will be interesting is whether or not this carcass transport ban is introduced next year.
Okay. Rich Kramer stays with us. He's our Wisconsin Public Radio reporter based in Eau Claire. When we come back, we'll talk about frac sand mining. I'm John Munson. This is the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. We'll shift our focus now to another topic that WPR's Western Bureau reporter Rich Kramer, based in Eau Claire, has been following, and that is frac sand mining. We've heard in recent months that there's once again a big demand for frac sand, and yet, as you report, some Wisconsin mines are shutting down and workers are being laid off. What's going on?
It's an interesting situation. Right now, it's predicted that by the end of this year, the national demand for frac sand, that is sand that's used in the hydraulic fracturing of shale deposits to get at the oil and natural gas, that demand is expected to hit more than 100 million tons, which is bar none a record for the U.S. But at the same time, where that sand is coming from has changed. So Wisconsin mines are getting shut out a bit because over the last year and a half, there have been 15 new mines that have opened up, big sand mines in Texas. And why that matters is right now, more than half of the drilling activity for oil and natural gas is happening in what's called the Permian Basin, which is in western Texas into New Mexico. It's just the busiest oil fields in the nation. So since these local sand mines have sprung up within trucking distance, they can, those drillers down there can use that local sand, and they found out that it works pretty well. They can use it at a fraction of the cost of shipping it across the country from Wisconsin, even though Wisconsin sand, called Northern White, is prized for its roundness and hardness. It's considered the best, but it's a lot of money to ship it across the country by rail.
So frac sand, Texas Oil Company is using locally generated comparatively locally generated sand from Texas. That's appealing to them. So what are mine operators and frac sand companies doing about the closures? Is there another market for Wisconsin's frac sand?
There is. There's drilling still happening in the Bakken, which is North Dakota, into Montana. There's oil fields and natural gas fields in places like New York, Pennsylvania, up in western Canada, Utah, there's the Colorado. So there's a lot of other places for Wisconsin to sell its sand. So I talked last week with a CEO for Superior Silica Sands. His name is Rick Shearer. And he said right now they are working as hard as they can to develop new customer base in those other oil fields. But that takes time, he said. And in the meantime, they've had to slow production because this local sand in Texas has displaced Wisconsin sand so much that even though demand is through the roof, it's not demand for our sand. So in the meantime, Rick Shearer told me that while they develop these markets, in the meantime, they have to ramp down production. Superior Silica Sand laid off 20 people. And there's another sand mine in Whitehall that shut down part of its operations and laid off 37. So do
we know where they're looking for new customers? We had a guest on this very show not too long ago who said that that sand is now an international market, and there's kind of an international shortage of the kind of sand that is important to frac sand mining. Are we looking at shipping sand overseas potentially?
That I'm not sure of. I do know that the Canadian oil field or Canadian oil companies are using it quite a bit, and that's one of the better for Wisconsin sands. It's all about transportation, so the further it gets, the more it costs. And when you tack on, you know, overseas shipping, I can only imagine what it costs. But I have not heard that. I've just heard that. They're just looking out to basically everywhere in the U.S. except for Texas and into Canada a little bit, too.
So the job losses in Wisconsin, as production is slowing down, as we've noted, how many jobs are we talking about here?
So far, I only know about 50. There's probably more than that, but it's tough. Unless you're able to get on the phone with every CEO for every company, which is unlikely, it's hard to know. And if they lay off a large enough number, then Department of Workforce Development sends out what's called a mass layoff notice. That's kind of the only chance that a person has to really find out what's going on, unless you've got, you know, close contacts in every company, which I'm working on at this point.
So what do we know about the economic impact, the secondary economic impact from frac sand mining? Some people say, hey, there's a really huge impact in local businesses and so forth. Others saying they haven't seen the kind of economic impact that they thought they would get. Where are we on this? What do you know?
Well, I know that it definitely, you know, if you go to a place like Whitehall and there's 30-some employees that lose their job, that's going to sting because those people, there's just not a lot of economic activity going on in that area. So it doesn't help, but again, it's hard to know because when the sand mines were popping up and really expanding in Wisconsin back in 2011, 2012, 2013, we'd see these economic, there would be these reports done to predict what the economic impact would be, and it would be thousands of jobs and just tremendous spillover. So we haven't necessarily seen that, but it's definitely like these companies use a lot of materials. They use a lot of metal. They have contractors for electrical, and I mean, they definitely do help the local economy. But to what extent, I don't have a dollar figure for you.
Okay, and of course you've got trucking and all sorts of other
a lot
things.
Of supportive industries that rely on it. That's for sure.
Rich, do you think could we get to a point where Texas sand becomes so readily available and so cheap that Wisconsin's frac sand industry just completely goes under?
I don't think so. It's just going through a transformation right now. So in Texas, even though the local sand is much more attractive to energy companies that are drilling there, Wisconsin sand is still making it in. So think of when they pump down these mixtures of sand and chemicals and to fracture the rock, they experiment with different technologies, different approaches. So they might use this really fine sand from Texas and then add a little bit of more coarse sand from Wisconsin, like a kind of mixing up a cocktail and injecting it into the shale deposits. So there is still some Wisconsin sand being used down there. And certainly their oil drilling is going to continue as long as oil prices are favorable in places like Colorado, North Dakota, you know, Marcellus over in New York, Pennsylvania. So there's activity. But right now, natural gas prices have been fairly flat. And the oil prices, you know, the sand mining industry in Wisconsin was born and really grew up while oil prices were like $100 a barrel. So we're not there yet.
But we're getting close.
We're getting close. So if we get up to $100 a barrel, you can expect everybody all around the country to go nuts with drilling. So then, you know, we might see Wisconsin sand mining industry is a cyclical industry chasing another cyclical industry. So the effects that happen in the oil fields don't really reach Wisconsin for some time. So we've got kind of a delayed reaction. And right now, in general, it seems to be that the oil industry and the sand mining industry is kind of going into another dip. That's what the analysts seem to think is happening.
So what you're describing is sort of a roller coaster effect up and down, makes it kind of tough on local communities where these businesses are kind of counted on to provide economic support to make any long-range plans for their local businesses. What else are you going to be watching for as we move forward here to kind of figure out where things are heading?
Well, I'm going to be watching very closely to see what other sand mines might be shutting down in the short term. But in the long term, I'm also hearing that just because of the nature of how things have changed with regard to the Permian Basin using the local sand, I'm expecting, the analysts expect to see a lot of acquisitions happening. So smaller companies that popped up when things were good in Wisconsin that rely on trucking to get sand from a mine to a processing facility, those are the types of facilities that are just not going to make it. So I'm expecting to see a lot of the bigger companies, the Hi-Crushes, the Covias and the Superior Silica Sands buying up these other mines and trying to work them into their operations.
All right. Thank you very much, Rich Kramer. I really appreciate your time this morning.
Thank you.
Rich Kramer is a WPR reporter based in Eau Claire. I'm John Munson. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.